Welcome, everyone, to the LaRouche Show. This is Saturday, January 8th, 2011. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic today is Glass-Steagall cuts off the head of the inter-alpha snake. Now, another way to put that is the Glass-Steagall policy ends once and for all the British Empire, you could say. And I'm very glad to have with us in the discussion today two guests. One, I welcome here live with me in the studio, Colin Lowry. Welcome, Colin.
Thanks, Marcia.
And Colin has a special part of this picture that has to do with the British Empire in the revolutionary period of the 1700s at the founding of our country. He will be getting to that shortly, even though you may know he's associated with the 21st Century Science and Technology magazine, but we're especially talking about history. It's scientific history, I assure you. But also on the line, I'm very glad to have Spencer Cross. Welcome, Spencer.
Thank you.
And Spencer's with us by telephone from the LaRouche Political Action Committee War Room and website editorial department. And he will have a lot to say, I'm sure, about the empire then and now, but about vanquishing it. Now, what I'd like to do on this is the second show of the new year, actually. I'm very glad. I hope anyone who hasn't gone to the archives to hear it. I'm very glad that Harley Schlanger closed out 2010 and introduced 2011 with interviews with the six LaRouche candidates in our country. So I point that out to everyone to listen to that. And I also want to say right up front that in just 2 weeks, January 22nd, on Saturday, will be the international webcast by Lyndon LaRouche. You can see his latest, well, his very important strategic evaluation called The Global Crisis Now at Hand on our website of LaRouchePub.com, as well as his Political Action Committee. And that's the point now, that we are at the make or break point about our chances to vanquish this imperial British Empire system, you can call it, that has been subverting in its figures, its agencies, its inner alpha banking, its commodity, its every wing, scientific, environmentalist hoaxes and so forth. It's been subverting the United States and downgrading the whole world now. And we have a chance, we have a task, a revolutionary task, to mobilize for the critical policies, the famous Franklin Delano Roosevelt period policy that works, Glass-Steagall, to reorganize the collapsing, blowing out financial system for a credit system that can resume advancement of our physical economy, especially with what you all, or many, I hope almost everyone knows, is the NWAPA, North American Water and Power Alliance approach to bioengineering the universe. But this requires, to put it in its briefest way, breaking with the way of thinking that's let people allow subversion of our nation. Breaking with these kind of policies of constant wars. Tony Blair is a special figure in this. Now there's a danger of war. There's an effort to perpetrate war in Africa and Sudan. We have continued war in Afghanistan. You can picture the map yourself. But all of this is part of just continuing globalization, continued looting, not banking, but inter-alpha banking is really looting. So it's self-destruction if we allow it to go on. And here we are the first week of the 2011, and we've seen, besides Washington coming into convening itself in Congress, I'm going to leave that topic aside as such, I think about 15 or 16 state legislatures have resumed this week, more of them next week. And many of the governor's speeches and the leaders of on the state level, are just discussing more self-destruction, what they can cut in order to try and balance budgets that are unbalanceable unless we get the economy going and have this Glass-Steagall intervention. So really, we have a subjective problem on our hands of fellow citizens who have risen up, especially in the summer of and August of 2009, against this imposition of this alien Nazi health care following the British model through Obamacare. People rose up, they rallied, they had town meetings, and they stayed mad. But in November, this past November election, they voted out a lot of office holders, but didn't rally to enforce, to mobilize to enforce the policies that would rescue and rebuild this country and the world. So that brings us again, as I said right at the outset, to the British Empire. You have to know your enemy. And with that, we're very much glad to have Colin here to go over some historical work he's done on the he has an article I want everyone to turn to on LaRouchePub.com, which is called The Real Boston Tea Party, December 16, 1773. So, Colin, would you begin with the what's involved in that? What characterized those real revolutionaries?
Well, the real Boston Tea Party is obviously nothing like what the self-described Tea Party people would know of today. I would bet almost none of them would know what really was behind the Boston Tea Party in 1773. This was really a very well-organized operation against the British Empire, against the British East India Company directly, which at that time was taking more and more control of the formal British government. This was also a resistance against a British colonial policy which had strangled the colonies economically for, at that time, 10 years since the end of the Seven Years' War. So the mentality of the Bostonians and New Englands who participated in that, these were people, some of whom were local elected officials, you might say, people like Samuel Adams and Dr. Joseph Warren, but the rest of them were, in some cases, mechanics, rope makers, ship workers, from every walk of society, who basically got together under their own kind of self-government, the town meetings at that time, to put an end to the British East India and British-sponsored plan to destroy any vestige of self-government in America and to have a complete empire monopoly control on basically all the commerce coming in and out of the American colonies at that time. So this really was one of the very first open steps to independence that was taken. And therefore, it's a very important event. People still probably know the name of it in school if they're taught anything, but they don't really understand what was behind it and what happened before. And we're going to get a little bit into that.
Well, let me, Spencer may jump in here, but if you would clarify a couple of leading things about one thing you said, that this British East India Company we're not talking about the English people, and we're talking pretty much by then about how it was a public-private partnership with the London government, right?
Yeah, the East India Company was a crown-chartered, technically private company originally, but it was a financier and trade company. In other words, it was responsible originally for the British taking control of India as a colony, a very large colony, very rich in raw materials. So the British East India Company basically had overall dominion over India and ran it as if they were their own government. Now, of course, they also had their directors in London, and they had immense amounts of raw power, money. They had their own military. They had their own ships. They, after a while, of course, acquired enough political power to have virtually their own lords and parliamentarians in their pocket, as well as the major ministries in the official government of England. Once we come to the 1760s, the relationship hits kind of a crisis point between the East India Company and the British government. The East India Company is going for a power grab. It's also expanding all over the world, not just in India. It's in China, Africa, the Caribbean, and also in the American colonies themselves. So it was very notorious at that time. And the American colonists were well aware of what their future would be if East India Company was allowed to completely run the policy from London that affected the colonies. And that would be the end of any American manufacturing of any kind, the end of even any decent trade outside of the United States coming in. So we would be basically subjected to what happened to India in those days, where India was a slave-style plantation for growing opium, for tea, silks, other raw materials, and even outsourcing. The original outsourcing, you might call it, in India, the British East India Company would build their own ships in India with slave labor because it was cheaper than doing it in England proper. So the East India Company directors, many of whom, of course, were either lords themselves or involved directly in the very large banks or financial houses in London itself, these people had no allegiance to England proper, really. So they didn't really care if they would damage the English home economy by their actions. They could care less. So they were a true empire view of the world, and certainly their plan was to use the India model on the United States, but not quite the same. Their disagreement with the British government in the 1760s was that the Tories, under allied to George III, had a rather hard-line policy against the Americans, and the smarter East India folks, allied with some of the English Whigs, such as Lord William Pitt, had an idea to manage the empire more as a commonwealth, which is what they did basically a century later. And that would be the original contention was, well, the Americans have no representation whatsoever in the English government. They don't have anybody in parliament. They have no vote, so to speak, in any of the policies. So the English Whigs and the East India Company folks would have been very happy to make a false compromise to allow the Americans to have representation, as token as it might be, but they would run the policy. So they wanted to avoid the open conflict that actually the king, King George III, was running headlong into in the early 1770s. Now, there's a couple of things that happened in England prior to 1773, which the Americans are well aware of, which changes basically their view of what the strategic options are for America at that time. In 1772, the year before the Boston Tea Party, there's the Official India Act, and the East India Company, its directors and financiers, have been battling the government for quite a while, part of the time to get more of a foothold officially in the English government. And the government itself, being rather weak and suffering from a huge debt crisis, sounds familiar to today, basically brings the East India Company partially into the government officially, where it does a swap. It basically will now have the Crown appoint four directors of East India Company, and the East India Board of Directors will appoint four members of the British government's Board of Trade. So the two are now officially married in policy. And the new target is America. And that's exactly the conflict that we see in 1773. Basically, the king is willing to, as he said, try the question with America. He wants to see that his absolute power over trade can be enforced, but he's going to do it using the East India Company. So at the time, the East India Company was also given a monopoly on the trade of most of the tea, in fact, all of the tea, coming into America and other parts of the world that had the same monopoly. And the trick, of course, was that the East India Company would collect the taxes on this tea and give it back to the Crown. Now, the Boston Tea Party is not some simple tax revolt at all. Even on its face, some people would say, well, they were just dumping the tea because they didn't want to pay the tax and they weren't represented in Parliament. That's not the whole story at all. This was a direct strike against the East India Company and the policies it represented, and also a signal by the Americans that they were not going to go the way of India. And how did they signal that? Well, when the Sons of Liberty actually dumped the tea off the ships in Boston Harbor, and they only dumped tea from the East India ships, nothing else, nothing was touched. They had one band of their Sons of Liberty dressed as Indians at the time. This was not the only time that happened. In fact, this was a national movement in 1773. The tea ships had already been to Philadelphia and had not been allowed to land. So in British law at the time, the tea would have to be unloaded at the port for them to collect the tax. The Americans knew this. So the resistance was to prevent it from being landed. In Philadelphia, that was done through the local militias, through town meetings, and forcing the tea basically to be taken back on its ships and leave. The ships went to New York, where they met again resistance at the New York town meeting, also Sons of Liberty there, and even the governor decided this was too messy. He wanted the ships to leave. So they came to Boston, which is the showdown of the Tea Party at that time. And if you saw the article, that's basically where the story picks up.
And, well, just to broaden one thing about this, you had another, you've mentioned either in the article or otherwise about Annapolis. In other words, again, this was the Americans had whole correspondence committees. They were in the know. And this wasn't just one mad act in the Boston Harbor at all, but Annapolis was involved. And so
that's right. This was a national movement. So after the Boston Tea Party, the Annapolis event is, there were, of course, East India ships coming all the time, were attempting to come and bring tea to the United States to collect the taxes. So after the Boston Tea Party, of course, the reaction of the British government is eventually to close the port of Boston entirely with the Boston Port Bill. But other ports, such as Annapolis, Maryland, they had ships bringing tea in as well, but the resistance there was just as strong. In fact, in that situation, two ships loaded with tea came to Annapolis Harbor in early 74, I believe, 1774, and the local people there were so up in arms that the captains of those ships basically came into Annapolis, and the leading figure in Maryland, one of them at the time, who was a signer of the Declaration of Independence, John Carroll, met with them, and they asked John Carroll, how can we get out of this predicament, basically with our lives? What can we do? And John Carroll calmly told them the only solution for them was to bring their ships into the harbor and burn them and their contents in view of the entire town. And that is exactly what they did. So the political ferment at the time was national. There was also an event that occurred in New Jersey from tea ships that had attempted to go to Philadelphia. This was after the Boston Tea Party as well. And those ships tried to go into a small river port on the Jersey side. And they were unloaded and the tea stored in a warehouse. But again, the local citizens and the Sons of Liberty found out where they were, broke open the warehouse in the middle of the night, put all the tea chests in the middle of the town square and lit them in a huge bonfire. And they were also dressed as Indians when they did this, sending a clear signal of what they were doing. And they knew they were, again, targeting the East India Company and its policies.
That was the opposite shore from Philadelphia or somewhere in the
vicinity.
This
is actually downriver a bit.
Downriver into.
Yeah, coming up the Delaware River.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are many points about this. We can go... We want to continue to bring them out about the exact history here. But, Spencer, let me turn to you. You, among the many things, there's two broad questions I have in mind, although you may want to just comment about what Colin had to say. One, you were in Boston for the Rachel Brown campaign, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you, there's a kind of, I'm interested if in your, there was a great LPAC video brought out about the early history. Colin, you were involved in that and so forth in Boston. So there's a kind of long wave of sense of who the enemy is, I think, maybe especially among the Irish. but also you write today, and you can don't have to answer these at the same time. You can choose your order, are trying to deal with choosing polemics, pedagogicals, documentaries, jokes to try and elicit to people understanding the who the enemy is today.
Mm-hmm.
So would you just address any of these things now that what Colin's laying out about really this extensive, deeper picture than is ever usually presented?
Sure. Well, I'd just say that, you know, with what Colin wrote, and we actually took what he wrote in LaRouche Pub and made it into a short feature film, which people can watch on LaRouchePack.com. But I think it couldn't be a timelier time to bring up what Colin is addressing with this Tea Party, because, you know, we've reported LaRouche Pub and LaRouche Pack for a couple of years now, that since the August 2009 period of what LaRouche describes a mass strike, you have a process where the economy is breaking down. People are looking to, you know, first Bush and Cheney, then recently Obama, for leadership, and they're seeing nothing but failure and austerity and, like, savage cuts in all kinds of budgets around the country, and just intentional, you know, subjugation and degradation of these peoples. And, you know, this, as Colin rightly was sort of deriding this so-called Tea Party movement, where there was a certain impulse to look back to the country's history and find a period where the population resisted this injustice, you might say. And the problem was, you know, when we're dealing with an uneducated population, they'll look back and they'll take a degraded or a reduced form or really distorted form of something like the Tea Party. And so I think it's very timely that you know, all of us are putting out this product now, because people need to know what the real Tea Party was, and the fact that it wasn't some tax-cutting austerity measure. That's what the British were doing. That's what we were fighting against. Maybe Colin and Marcia, maybe you guys saw a couple of days ago when the Congress opened, I think it was on Thursday, and the Republican majority, there was this big show, it was almost like a dumb show, of they're reading the Constitution, right?
Right.
And one man, actually, a man who's likely the potential opponent of Diane Sayre, a place that Diane might be running, in northern New Jersey, is Representative Garrett. And I don't know if you guys saw this, but he had this terrible thing about how, you know, the main thing was they're going to have this, all legislation will have to cite which part of the Constitution it's exercising. But the Republicans said, well, everything but the term general welfare, because that can be used too loosely. And then this particular man, Representative Garrett, said, yes, and especially as refers to Section 1, Article 1, Section 8. Which, Colin, you know, maybe you heard about this. Maybe you'll have some fun talking about that. But just this question of Hamilton, the real credit policy of the United States, and it just go, you know, flies in the face of everything the Constitution stands. I mean, Article 1, Section 8 is, like, as LaRouche said, the pinnacle, along with the preamble of how the Constitution expresses itself in economics and statecraft. So maybe you guys have thoughts on that. But that's just, I thought that was worth bringing up, you know.
Right, I think that's a classic, because this Scott Garrett fellow,
mm-hmm.
and depending on redistricts or whatever, but I understand Diane Sayre may be too bad for Scott Garrett.
I know, he's asking for it.
Yeah. I understand even some of his Republican colleagues then said, no, that's too far to say you can't motivate a bill.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the name of saying the general welfare and so forth. But that brings up what I'd like to refer people, Spencer, to what you did on Lyndon LaRouche's weekly LPAC. He was interviewed on the LPAC weekly show this week.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I think even before he heard what you just described happened, it happened Wednesday morning, is that he said, well, there's a lot of cross-conflict. There's a lot of confusion. The Republicans, some of the office holders that got elected in November or reaffirmed, like this Scott Garrett, I think, rode in on this wave of resistance that we've just been, of anger.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But they themselves absolutely oppose what many of the citizenry in a kind of non-think way, but a deeper impulse. You know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
They opposed the Nazi Obamacare and so forth, but these people want it. So it creates tremendous opportunities as well as wild situations.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, let me just ask one thing about this. On that weekly show, it struck me that LaRouche said too, or other people have said, the one thing is that, you know, people need a sense of the positive, right? You're not just going to vote out the bums,
mm-hmm.
and then you try. And Colin, you may say about it, or Spencer, you've been in Boston. In the past, Americans were making something in Massachusetts. That they had done it since the 1600s. They were doing so in Pennsylvania. In other words, the colonists were even in the advance of things like ironworking. And so what was at stake was known to them. So you may... So when you said that these revolutionaries who carried out these acts in New York, Annapolis, Philadelphia, and Boston, many of them were very explicit about knowing that this set down the gauntlet. This was going to be a real fight. But they also knew what they were fighting for, right?
They did, because, especially Massachusetts with its history going back more than 100 years before the Tea Party, being the first place where American history was really founded. So the iron industry is mostly founded in Massachusetts first. It's in Virginia, too, but that's a little later. Saugus Iron Works, of course, very famous. The first automated rolling, slitting, and iron furnace in America. And this is back in the mid-1640s, I believe. This was a project of the original founders of Massachusetts. And that project then trained the other iron workers, iron masters, who then spread out through the rest of New England and then eventually through the rest of what became the United States. So it was well understood early on that if you couldn't develop and manufacture, then you would still be a colony of raw material export, which was the British Empire model. And this is exactly what the East India Company was trying to now enforce, even at the point of the British, you know, the war breaking out in 1775, that this was the core issue. Really was what the Americans were fighting for was obviously their own self-government, but their own self-government for a purpose of a republic, to develop all the citizenry, to abolish the monarchy, oligarchical system, everything that went with that. And the East India Company was basically the leading edge of the empire, and this was the absolute object of attack of the Boston Tea Party and the national movement. And previous to this, this just didn't happen overnight. So at the end of the Seven Years' War in 1763, this is when the British first launched their, I'd call it their secondary attack against the American colonies to stop them from developing. And they did it through a series of acts, the Iron Act, the Stamp Act, and the Townsend Acts. And these were all acts that restricted the production of manufactured goods or imposed very heavy taxes on even importation of most of the goods coming into the American colonies. But the Americans' response was the creation of what was known as the non-importation movement. The non-importation movement wasn't some fun thing where people run around with a bumper sticker that says "Buy American."
Buy local.
Yeah, right.
This was
go
way
local,
beyond
die,
that.
Right.
In other words, they were actually, yes, they were producing what they needed. They were producing their own wool, their own clothes, their own iron, their own paper, glass. They were learning and producing and protecting all these industries, and then even things they gave up, such as English tea. And this was universal in many ways. It was not restricted to everybody but the rich did this. That's not at all the case. In Boston, actually, in 1770, when the Townsend Acts were fully repealed, but the tax on tea remained, and then it was altered in 72. At that time, in 1770, 300 women, some of them the heads of the most wealthy and politically famous families in Boston, all signed a public agreement not to drink any tea until the Revenue Act was completely repealed. And in the newspapers in Boston, the daughters of all these families basically had a pledge. We, the daughters of the Patriots, basically, for the public interest, we will not drink foreign tea until this is done. This was, again, this was published right in front of the British in their face. You have to remember, there, you know, we're talking 1770. There was no freedom of the press per se. You could print something if you thought you wouldn't be arrested, jailed, or hung, because that was the England that you were dealing with at that time. There was no freedom of the press. This is a very important thing in America. Yes, we print a lot of things that were, at the time, considered close to almost treason, but there was only so far you could go with it at that time. So what these people did, I mean, the risks they took in the Tea Party were absolutely life and death. And I'll explain a little more why that is. Not in the article, it's a little more of the background of the event of why did they choose December 16th, 1773? And there's actually a very good reason. Under English law at the time, the original tea ships had come into Boston Harbor 19 days before that point. At the time, in English law, under the Navigation Acts, a ship sitting in port 20 days, not unloaded, could be seized by the local British commander, navy, or army, and the goods forcibly landed at the port. Now, in Boston, the 19th day was December 16th, that night. Had they waited one more day, then the local British commander at Castle William could have ordered his real British troops to unload the ships protected by guns. And then the Americans would have had a very difficult time trying to run that operation. So they basically took every step they could until they were out of options. And literally, at the midnight before this would have occurred, December 16th, they launched the Tea Party operation to dump the tea. Before that time, in the Boston town meetings run by the leadership, including Samuel Adams and Joseph Warren and Josiah Quincy, they had legally petitioned that the ship captains must leave the port. And the problem was the governor of Massachusetts, Hutchinson, was a pretty stout Tory, and he wanted the conflict. Some of the local British officers probably were not too thrilled with him. They really did not want to push this to the point of an armed conflict at that time. But he did, and he denied the ship captains the passes they would need to leave port. So those guys were stuck. Two of the captains actually wanted to get out once they knew how serious the situation was, that the entire town was getting up in arms and wanted the tea out of there. But they couldn't legally leave. They couldn't bring the ships out without a pass from the governor. And he did not grant that in a way to push this to a potential armed conflict. So, again, the town meeting that day, December 16th, was very, very serious. And Josiah Quincy's speech, which I have the quote in the article, which you could read, you can see reflected that it's gone way past the time of cheers, huzzas, and speeches. That it's now the time where real action is going to be taken that is going to be a life and death choice, possibly, for those involved. And there will be no turning back from that point. And historically, there wasn't. After the Boston Tea Party, this was a series of events and escalations that led in 1775 to the outbreak of the Revolutionary War. For most people looking at it at that time, in leadership and also in England, after the Boston Tea Party, they kind of knew that this was the turning point, that this would come to an armed conflict. And lucky for us, we defeated the British Empire, and that's why we're talking here today.
Yeah, and to repeat what Colin just said, find this article, and those of you who have a subscription to EIR Online get several more now. It's the new year for other people. And to the quote he mentioned, Josiah Quincy, he said in particular, he said, "Whoever supposes that shouts and hosannas will terminate the trials of the day entertains a childish fancy." And that's certainly a message to anyone who just wants to have enraged anger.
Exactly. It's also a beautiful warning for today, because I think a lot of people, again, around the Tea Party, believe that you can just protest something and that's going to work. It won't. The colonial leadership, the Patriots, had a solution. They were building a nation state. They were going for industrial policy. Yeah, they had to beat the British Empire on the field of battle to do it. But they didn't win the revolution and then just throw their hands up and say, well, we got rid of those guys, now what do we do? They had already established, basically in their own traditions, especially in New England, how a self-government would be run, how an economy would develop on a continental basis. And this had been worked on for a long time. So in many ways, looking back at that leadership, you know, these people, again, came from all walks of life. They kind of remind me of a lot of the people around the LaRouche movement, actually, just in a different time. But it's a very different mentality that they actually had than what is portrayed now, historically, about this time, as if they were just a bunch of, you know, a bunch of wild hotheads who just ran onto some ships in the Boston Harbor and broke open tea chests and threw them in the water.
Accidentally.
And that was it. And the next day, nothing happened. All right, that was the end of the story. That's not the end of the story. That's the beginning of a whole new chapter of the American Revolutionary history and its identity. I think it's very important that people actually grasp who these people were, what motivated them, and the policies they were fighting for, which are really the same things as today. It's just a different context.
Well,
go ahead.
So I was just turning to Spencer, because just the point you're making about today parallels, and on a much deeper level too, the idea of what you're fighting for. And Spencer, I was looking in September when you were interviewed after Rachel Brown's primary election, on which you were talking about how she won 1 out of 5 votes, I think. And since then, much has happened, and you're dealing with national, these LaRouche political LPAC videos and so forth. But you stressed at the time that people were picking up on what we ought to be doing in the world, especially in the WAPA. And so, could you speak about that?
Sure. Well, Rachel and Rachel Brown, definitely, but also just the campaign nationally and the campaign in Boston have really led the way. Because think about even what we're seeing now with this whole Rand Paul, this whole Republican wave of fascist policies coming through. I mean, there was a sort of a proto case in Massachusetts before Rachel announced her candidacy against the other Brown, Scott Brown.
Oh, yeah.
Where he was his great white hope, and everyone was pissed off at Obama, and they didn't like the health care bill, and they thought, you know, sort of getting back to this idea that you can think about history simply, you know, because that never works. You can never think about, like, oh, we're against taxes or something. Because someone like Scott Brown rode in on a wave like that, and, you know, we dealt with the population. We politically organized the population there before and after his election. And we were going up to them, look, you know, this guy is not what you bargained for. First thing he does is compromises on the health care bill, then compromises in a severe way on Barney Frank, the Frank Dodd financial bailouts. Right? And just about every, like 90% of the people that we ran into politically organizing in the street, we talked to him and say, look, do you know what Scott Brown did in this Dodd Frank bill? And he said, yeah. Yeah, we know, it's a disappointment. And now you get the same thing. That's sort of a test case for what you're seeing now, where you got this big Republican wave, and they're going against. In one sense, they didn't get the memo. They didn't get the memo from the population for why they were elected. They've actually gone completely against that, and so that's just one of the reasons we have to be just really clear on this question of history, what the legacy is. I mean, you have, like we mentioned before, this Representative Garrett going almost explicitly against the Alexander Hamilton constitutional credit policy legacy in the country, saying, no, basically saying we should just remove these parts of the Constitution. That's basically what as a federal elected representative saying, no, we don't really need to listen to this whole, you know, general welfare fooey. And so it's just up to us to really provide the clear issues from the historical picture up to today. And then that's, of course, what Rachel's doing. And then now they have 6 candidates total going for that same effect nationally. So it's exciting. And just one other thing on something you brought up earlier, Marcia, something you were raising on this question of LaRouche bringing up the positive element.
Yes, please.
Because that's really important and something he's been talking about with some of his associates around here is the period when Franklin Roosevelt came in. And this is, of course, something we talk a lot about, but it was really important for the population at that time to see the clear policy, even though they knew that it wasn't going to be some immediate shift, per se. I mean, if we implement the NWAPA project, you know, preceded by the Glass-Steagall banking regulation, just like Franklin Roosevelt, then it might not be some like, oh, tomorrow everything's sunny and great, but you will get in the population a sense that there is a change, and they're going to start to see people getting back to work and getting off the unemployment rolls, and even in some cases it would be a step up to get on the unemployment rolls.
Yeah, to get on Medicaid, yeah. If there is any. Yeah, right.
So that's really, I think, really important too, just this sense of like, okay, we have a mission. You know, we at LaRouche PAC have laid it out very clearly what has to happen. And the population is just craving that. They're not craving for austerity. That's the last thing they're craving. You know, so the argument that that's what they need and they need less taxes, no, that's not true. That's what they did in Germany in the 30s. That's not what Americans do. That's what the British do.
Right. Well, this last phrase of yours is what the British do. This British Empire pedigree, you've been bringing that out. I know you personally, Spencer, did that in terms of something you did in Oregon and like kind of 15-year history of how, I don't know why, maybe Colin does, is that that place seems to be the center for this nest of certain kinds of operations in the country to bring in Hitlerian euthanasia and so forth. You did this thing called Horroragon or whatever you call it.
Uh-huh.
But that isn't that part of what you're saying to describe the British pedigree on these kinds of operations?
Definitely, definitely. Lynn wanted us to call the piece The Case of Horrorgon.
Oh, okay.
But no, it is this fascist model of economics which permeates really the younger generations very explicitly nowadays, where the idea is, look, we can't afford to have, we can't afford to take care of human life. And so, you know, the argument slips in, this little foot in the door for fascism where they say, well, you know, people that are terminally ill and like they're on their deathbed and it costs X thousands, many thousands of dollars to keep them alive for a couple more weeks. So why don't we just pull it early? And then once you get that policy adopted, which they've done in Oregon and other great, in Washington State also, Montana, that is the core of the Obama's health care bill. And it's the core of this pessimistic world outlook, which is the British outlook. This idea that human life is on the same level as the beasts, and, you know, a profit value or a dollar bill or whatever, or, you know, a shareholder value in the British East India Company is more important than the sanctity of human life. And we've seen it to devastating effect in Oregon, and just it's really got going now in Washington State. But, there's tons of just assisted suicides, and we don't even know the number because they have to lie about they have to lie on the death certificates to say it's a natural death. So it's hard to even tell how much of it's going on. And it's also very clear that it's being done for economic reasons. You know, these people are in these conditions where they think it's a moral thing because there's been the safety net's been ripped up. You know, the industry's been ripped up in the country. Wall Street's gone rampant. We've let the British policy take over the United States. So they're at that point, and it's a false paradox. It's a false dichotomy because the policies exist to put Wall Street in jail, put them in their place, and go back with the recovery policies. So there's no, you know what I mean? It's a fake dichotomy.
Right. That's what you have to do to make cuts.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, on this question of optimism, I mean, if you want to say any more about the historical basis, the Mathers, the concept of the good, I mean, there and the literal experience and involvement of people and being in agriculture and advancements in iron, the iron industry, as you just said, that was fortunately very prevalent, or as you said, we wouldn't be here today.
Yeah, I mean, this goes back to the founding of Massachusetts Bay Colony itself, which is part of the founding of the United States. In 1630, I mean, you had John Winthrop basically launched this operation, a little different than the Pilgrims. You know, people know about the Pilgrims in 1620 in Plymouth, and, you know, they had some good folks, but they didn't have a nation-building outlook, and they certainly weren't prepared for it. When John Winthrop sailed into Boston in 1630, he had already collected, as best he could, artisans, mechanics, woodworkers, shipbuilders. He had people that could design fortifications, some of the early people that could work on iron working, you name it. They were looking at it as if, I need to take every kind of knowledge and craft required to create a new full country on, at that time, shores that were known, but very little was known of what was really here. So they launched this kind of in the way you could say it would be like going to the moon for them in 1630. You're going to the moon, you're going to need to take everything you need and then find what the local resources are and start building. Now, luckily, Massachusetts in 1630 is a little easier than the surface of the moon, and there were local people here, too, who actually helped the original colonists a great deal in many ways, especially with growing crops and learning how to fish in the local shores. But that was the whole intent of the original Massachusetts Bay colonization. It wasn't just an escape. It wasn't just religious refugees. Obviously, that was an important feature. But actually, some people might also forget the very important reason why religious freedom in the United States is in the Constitution is to avoid the nightmare of religious war, which Europe was virtually destroyed by at the time that the colonists came here. The 30 Years' War erupts in 1618 and doesn't really end till 1648. When the Massachusetts Bay colonists come here, they are leaving a Europe that is basically being thrown into a vicious Dark Age warfare cycle that seems never-ending. And so this idea of religious freedom was not just about the individual. It was also about preventing a society from ever being manipulated into religious warfare ever again. This is explicit in the original settlement of the country and then made law in the Constitution, which you will find is very unique in the rest of the world. So, again, unlike any country you can probably think of, the founding principles of the United States exist in the original colonies long before the Constitution is written. And again, also with that is a commitment to scientific progress, a commitment to exploration, a commitment that actually we would be a bastion for the world, but the idea also of the American revolutionaries, and I'm speaking now of the revolutionary time, was to then export the ideas of the revolution back into Europe to save Europe. In fact, many of the English Whigs who were pro-American believed that before the Revolution, the Americans would be the one to save what they knew as their original English liberties, their rights. That their rights were being destroyed in England of the early 1770s, which they were, completely being taken away. An absolute stratified society of very, very rich and a ton of poor and virtual slaves and no opportunity. You could not do anything. If you were born poor in London in 1770, that's the way you were going to stay or end up in a workhouse or die a very nasty early death. There was nothing like what you would see in the American colonies. It was a totally different world, culturally, physically even, between the two at that time. So in one sense, people focus on the political differences between the colonies and England, but there was a huge cultural gap that could not be bridged. And some books on Paul Revere and his family, when part of his family was French and English mixed, went back to England, I believe in the 1750s, they could not fit in. In fact, all the English looked at them as if they were people from another world. By their attitudes and what they thought, their view of the world was already completely different than your typical Englishman, especially a merchant. They did not look at the world as an empire. And it was already true at that time. So really, the American Revolution, the ideas of it, were already the cultural values of most of the American population. It just took the leadership and the events and the actual struggle to make it a reality for the government that we now still have.
Well, Spencer, it seems we're not really crossing any ocean to change the world. But we certainly have to do, from what you were just saying, Colin, it's like a lot of the same tasks are before us, maybe even more difficult. Let's not worry about comparative difficulty. It seems difficult, but Spencer, you're involved. You've been in discussions with LaRouche and others, though, about trying to intervene, to engage people to change their identity towards cultural optimism instead of this pessimism today. Do you want to say something about that, either in terms of the including regionally in the country, about engagement in the prospect of NWAPA, that it has to come about, but what does it mean?
Yeah, well, one thing is that one of the features we're working on developing much more fully on the webpage is this citizens report, this on-the-ground report, and just featuring our candidates a lot more because, you know, if you go out and you politically organize the population in the streets or with people you know, then they know that the economy's crashed and there's no policies coming out of Washington. There's nothing novel in telling people that. That's sort of what they get on the news. The Congress is insane. But what we aim to provide is this question of what can we do, how are we going to do it, how are we going to organize, and I think that's represented with the candidates for sure. These six candidates, they have their respective regions, but they have a national approach. And you tell people, look, you know, you thought the Democrats were so bad, and now you got people that are much, you know, in a certain sense, the Republicans are just a lot more in your face with the fact they want to kill you. You know, Democrats might want to do it with a smile or something, but these guys are like, oh, no, this, we have to cut the budget. We have to kill you. Can't afford to treat your grandma, this sort of thing. So it's important for them to get the sense, no, look, there's a different tradition. Our candidates represent the old patriotic tradition in the United States. You know, George Washington, Lincoln, JFK, FDR, John Quincy Adams, you know, John Winthrop, Cotton Mather, and we can get this policy, and we can get NWAPA, and it has to take place with the removal of Obama immediately, and then the Glass-Steagall regulation put in place. We have to have these defenses. We have to defend the population. If we put in Glass-Steagall, these state bankruptcies would be eliminated instantly. You could provide emergency aid to the states. You could have all these state functions, these social net type programs. You can immediately get people back to work. And that is a lot more real to people, and it's a lot more, you know, sometimes people don't know about that per se. They don't know the specifics. They may not have ever heard of NWAPA, but there is something just completely real about this historical patriotic tradition in the country where they respond to that instantly as though they already knew it. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things why I mentioned the Citizens Report, because we're aiming to have a lot more activity on the webpage with these citizens reports, these on-the-ground reports, interviews with people on NWAPA, and just the breakdown and the Glass-Steagall, and these sorts of things, because we want the population to understand that, you know, our webpage, LaRouche PAC, has that responsibility, and they can work with us as not just people that are sort of passive participants, but we want the population to organize. And our webpage, among many things that we do in this movement, is a very powerful tool to do that. And so that's something we're going to be working on. But just to bring that optimism back, you know, because the people will respond. They might be skeptical or something, but they're ready for it. They're ready for the solutions. We don't need to tell them anything about what's wrong, really. They know, they have a sense. You know, they know what that is. And so just making it clear, even this question of the extraterrestrial imperative. You know, the fact that mankind as a whole is in a crisis where, you know, the sun is going to blow out. It's not going to be, you know, Obama will be long gone by then. but it is a condition we have to face. And mankind is in the same boat with respect to that. So are we going to just sit here and collapse and argue about how we're going to kill grandma faster? Or are we going to talk about how we're going to organize society to make the new technological leaps to begin, you know, developing other planets? And other, you know, the extraterrestrial imperative for mankind. So that's something we look to to provoke and inspire in the population.
Right. Let me throw in here, you're talking about the webpage and that's it. I mean, internationally, people are looking at this. I'll mention again, this is the LaRouche Show for January 8th, but January 22nd, Mr. LaRouche is holding an international webcast based in the Washington, D.C. vicinity. It'll be 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and people know to look on the LaRouchePAC.com website for that. But, Spencer, let me throw in here that you've been speaking of the six banner flagship candidates, LaRouche candidates in the country for Congress, and January 15th, that's going to be next Saturday. They are available in the Mid-Atlantic states in New Jersey at 1 p.m., two of them, Rachel Brown from Boston, Diane Sayre from New Jersey. It's at Hasbrook Heights. People can look on your LaRouchePAC.com website. It's 1 p.m. Eastern time, but you can go. It's time to pick up and go, as well as otherwise. I'm sure you'll make a lot of that available. And other. Do you want to say anything more about this or upcoming, not just the event, but I know you have special connections to Seattle and Dave Christie's campaign, perhaps also.
Well, yeah, that's. I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, we have. You can really think about this month as just a series of events building into one another. First, the one you mentioned with Diane Sayre and candidate Rachel Brown, and then the week after that, I believe it's Friday or Saturday. It's on the webpage anyway. But Dave Christie is going to be down in the Bay Area working with one of our veteran candidates, Summer Shields, who ran against Nancy Pelosi last time and hopefully is going to do so again. And really the issue is, like, with this NWAPA program that I think hopefully people are familiar with, that at least those two events, even as far as they go, are great manifestations of it. Because the East Coast, you have, you know, some people say, well, why should we in the East Coast be concerned about NWAPA? You know, we're not going to get any of the water, you know, all these things. But if you think about, well, where is the industrial capability? And you think about how much concrete we're going to have to send to build the NWAPA program, you're not going to want to send the concrete over, you know, Boeing jets. You're not going to want to ship it in air. You're going to have to build the rail lines to do that. And the place you're going to organize that is Diane's campaign, Rachel's campaign, and then Bill Roberts in Detroit as well. And then with Dave and Dave Christie running in the Washington State area and in Summer's campaign, the idea is, look, we have to actually expand this NWAPA program to think about the global implications. And one of the interesting things about the Northwest was it was originally set up as sort of the bridge through Alaska to Russia, with the original trade. You know, Washington Irving talks about this. But that and then the Bay Area with the view towards China, this is the Pacific orientation that LaRouche brought up earlier in the week on Wednesday in his weekly report. But this is the future of mankind. And that's what these campaigns represent. It's not just a way to get the Republican fascists out or something, or just to save the Democratic Party. It's what's the policy going to be for the future of mankind, and how are we going to organize the four powers, Russia, India, China, and the United States, to do this, to ditch this empire system, not just from England, but from the globe forever. Because it's a childlike system of global governance, and we don't need it.
Yeah, we need national governments, not this... Colin, you've been talking about British East India Company governance. That's what you might call it at the time, colonialism, these words.
Yes, it was the original globalization, really. Their idea was a global empire, and they were going to knock anybody out in their way, and they almost succeeded if it wasn't for the United States. Mm-hmm. They were the only thing that actually defeated them. They didn't, of course, completely go away. We all know that story. They're still here, but... We were definitely the greatest loss that the British Empire ever has suffered. And hopefully we can give them another great loss very soon.
Oh, Colin, thanks. That seems to be the last word we have time for. And so I want to thank you, Colin Lowry, Spencer Cross. It's January 8th, 2011. This is the LaRouche Show. It's Marcia Mary Baker. I thank you all, and stay tuned January 15th and January 22nd. Be sure to hear Mr. Lyndon LaRouche's international webcast. Thank you very much.